Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, all about action to stem climate change. The landmark Inflation Reduction Act that passed Friday includes $369 billion in climate and energy-related funding, some tax breaks for electric vehicles, incentives to ramp up carbon capture facilities, also to encourage green hydrogen production and boost U.S. manufacturing of solar panels, wind turbines, and next-generation batteries. The historic action will make cleaner energy cheaper for everyone. There is also money set aside for so-called nature-based climate solutions, about $20 billion for agricultural conservation, and $5 billion to safeguard forests around the country. This half hour, we want to get reaction to the climate change legislation passed by Congress from here in Iowa. Also, learn about existing community climate action plans now in place, in many cases, have been in place for several years, and how this new influx of federal spending will improve local efforts to stem climate change. Joining us for the full hour is Komyar Enchayan. He is the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa, joining us from Cedar Falls. Komyar, welcome to our program.
Great to be with you, Ben.
You work with different municipalities on their own climate goals. We'll hear from some of those this half hour. You've been director of the center for the last 14 years, I understand. We want to reach out to our listeners. If you don't hear your community mentioned during this half hour, why don't you call and ask a question or chip in what your community's climate action plan is all about? Or if you're unaware of your community having one, how you can spur your community into creating one? That'll be a question a little bit later on that I'll have for Komyar. But let's start off by having you introduce us to your center for those who don't know about it, Komyar.
Yes, great. Yes. So the Center for Energy and Environmental Education basically is an arm of the University of Northern Iowa, and we provide services, technical education, and technical assistance services to Iowa communities. We do that in kind of three areas of work. Energy and climate is one. Food systems, how to strengthen Iowa's local food system, as well as improving environmental health of our community. So those are the areas where we, our staff, have expertise, and we work with communities. So over the last many years, for example, one of our biggest programs that relates directly with kind of transitioning away from fossil energy is our Green Iowa AmeriCorps program, which is a fantastic program of college graduates help stationed at various communities and offering energy audits and weatherization. So they kind of basically focus on energy conservation in communities. So that's kind of, we're very action-oriented. We work with local governments primarily, but we work with nonprofits. We work with a variety of community organizations who want to create change in their communities. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do.
How is your center funded? Exclusively through the University of Northern Iowa?
No, actually about maybe less than 10% of our budget comes from the University of Northern Iowa. And we're very grateful for that. We have a building with a roof over our head. We don't have to raise money for that. But the other 90% we raise through every year through grants, contracts, foundations. We got to hustle to get done the things that we think improves Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So we want to learn about, what a climate action plan is in just a moment. But before we do, let's go to the headlines of the past few days with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, with the hundreds of billions of dollars, the largest investment our country has ever made toward stemming climate change. details, of course, need to be worked out. It hasn't even been signed by the president yet. So, but there is, it seems, no stopping it now. This massive spending bill, can you say at this early date without knowing any details, in broad brushstrokes, what's your reaction?
Well, I'm pleased that at the federal level, we will be investing in clean energy. And hopefully it finds its way to communities. And yes, investing in renewable energy, transitioning away from fossil energy. Now, there may be parts of this plan that, may be false solutions. I don't know. But we know for sure the parts that are will be very helpful to local communities are, you know, maybe helping cities develop climate action plans, helping states basically make their states more resilient in the face of extreme weather that we're facing. So a lot of it, I think the best thing is that funds would be helping communities become more resilient. And that's where local governments come in. And I guess I want to say two things about that's where my experience is, right? I'm not a big policy expertise or anything, don't have that expertise, but my direct experience of helping communities in Iowa convinces me that's where the action is. So there are two reasons local governments are in a very, leading positions they can be. One is that's where most people live, right? That's where the populations are, and that's where the solutions and dealing with extreme weather happens. And secondly, is that local governments, cities, counties, that and schools is where the bulk of the damage happens. It's, when the flooded neighborhoods, washed out roads and bridges, damage from the wind, who has to mop up after those things? It's local governments. It's the local fire departments, local governments. So that's where I think it's such an important topic that you've chosen to discuss. And I'm really looking forward to hear the other speakers you have invited because that's, that's such a huge opportunity. And I'm hoping some of the funds that are in this big, inflation reduction bill that hopefully will be signed will end up with local governments and local communities.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Of course, any question connected with the implementation of the hundreds of billions of dollars targeted towards stemming climate change, or perhaps what you're doing on the ground in your community, or perhaps worries that you're not doing enough in your community to stem climate change. Komiar is definitely the one to bounce that off of. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Before we move on, a couple of things jumped out at me here. You said false solutions. What would be an example of a false solution? Of course, once this becomes law, we hope these monies are used as effectively as possible. But that jumped out at me. We can be spending money on things that are not effective.
That's right. And there is a lot of evidence for that, too. So one of the ones that's actually a hot topic in Iowa is the so-called carbon capture. And it's like the most effective way to address climate change is to reduce our energy consumption. And the carbon capture that nature does it is already happening, and we need to do more of that. But the idea of capturing and putting pipelines, all these schemes that are proposed, there is absolutely no evidence that they will do any good. And everything, and so yes, so yeah. That's for debate.
Well, right,
that's
for debate. Right. Environmentalists are against these pipelines. Of course, they've teamed up. It's a case of sort of strange bedfellows in terms of politics, right? Because you have environmental interests teaming up with, in some cases, farmers who don't want this to cross their land, even if they're paid for it. But past that, these carbon pipelines then you know, give us a sense that what the carbon is being liquefied, it's being taken care of, so we don't have to cut back? Is that your worry?
That's right. And that they're used for more and more oil and gas exploration.
Right.
So the whole issue of our activities impacting the stability of the atmosphere is the question. What activities are destabilizing the atmosphere? It's the consumption of fossil fuel.
Yeah.
It's like very straightforward. Carbon capture will not deal with that.
We have to change our energy habits. We have to deal with it. You're saying at the front end, for it's less expensive, less effort to deal with it at the front end than cleaning up the mess, the carbon mess later.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Let's go to a quick phone call. Mike is with us in Iowa City, 1-866-780-9100. If you just joined us, my guest for the entire hour, director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa, Komiar and Cheyenne. And Mike, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Komiar, thank you for being on today. And Ben, thanks for covering this really important subject. And I have to agree about false climate change solutions. We know that we can get to 100% renewable energy with wind, solar, hydro, and storage. And so if we're really concerned about climate change, we just have to quit burning everything, including nuclear power. And so this IRA bill of 2022, Inflation Reduction Act, has $369 billion for climate work. But a lot of it is for false climate change solutions like carbon capture, nuclear, but a lot of it is really good stuff for wind and solar. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you were talking about is how do communities get this money and nonprofits and churches before we've had an investment tax credit of 30% federally, and it's been phased out a little bit. But what's happening is in this act, it takes it back to 30%. And nonprofits and communities and counties that don't pay taxes can actually monetize that. Instead of a tax credit, they'll actually get a rebate. And if you're a low-income person, you could get a 10% kicker, so you would get a 40% tax credit. So this is a really great environmental justice thing because most poor people can't afford solar. So
okay.
This helps them. So,
Mike in Iowa City, thank you very much. Would you like to comment on that, Komiar?
No, that makes sense. Again, I don't know the details of what this bill will entail, but those are exactly some of the kind of processes that we need to put in place to make sure the funds, I'm sure, again, the ones that we have control over. I mean, if there's some whole bunch of money is going to carbon capture, you know, it's like, okay, what can City of Waterloo do about that? I don't know. But the parts that can help communities, we got to be very creative and say, okay, how can we help schools, churches, all these different entities in our state, in each community, first of all, reduce their consumption of, you know, electricity and natural gas and everything, and invest in renewable sources that we know are already working and we just need to scale up.
Right.
So
with this federal money, it seems, you know, one of your challenges, your upcoming challenges, since the local municipalities have had to sort of carry the burden of climate change action up to this point. Now the federal government has acted. So it seems to me your challenge in the coming years with the implementation of this act is to mesh your challenges, your actions in a way that uses those federal dollars and incentives most effectively. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, very much, very much. Mm-hmm. So okay, so let me kind of just to give some tangible examples of what local governments could be doing, right? There's like a variety of things that requires major investment, and this fund can be helpful. For example, community, and we know Iowa, many parts of Iowa have experienced flooding. So rethinking floodplain management and redesigning the ordinances to be more protective and give more room to the rivers, That takes time and effort, might involve some, you know, upstream land acquisition or some sort of a, you know, incentivizing. It could be investing in public transportation, could be redesigning the energy codes in the city so that the, say, big commercial buildings and residential are a lot more energy conserving. And there are incentives for solar on their rooftops. And, you know, I mean, there's so many making their communities more walkable. Things like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, because we do want to get around the state. We want to go to Dubuque in just a moment. Yeah. We want to go to Des Moines, talk with a guest in Des Moines. But let's make sure we understand what climate action plans are at a community level here. What are they? How many Iowa communities have them?
Yeah, so quite a few. So it basically is a plan that a community, usually city or could be school, could be county, but right now we've worked mostly with cities, and basically it involves, you know, a goal for a city to reduce their energy consumption or put a percentage on what portion, you know, by certain year, how much they wish to reduce their emissions and invest in clean forms of energy. So the way we've worked with communities like City of Dubuque, City of Decorah, City of Des Moines, City of Cedar Falls, Waterloo, we've worked with smaller communities, Independence, Ankeny. So we start out with basically benchmarking the existing emissions, where let's say we do an analysis this year, we can pinpoint, based on the data that cities collect, we know how much goes to vehicle, consumed by vehicles, how much natural gas all the homes and businesses have burned, how much electricity they've used. All of this, we add them all up and kind of develop a picture of what the emissions by sectors in a community look like. And then the city council and the residents, through a planning process, can set a goal and a set of actions that would help them become more resilient. And sometimes, obviously, energy plays a big role, but as I mentioned, there are so many other elements that aren't directly an energy action. For example, making a town more resilient to floods of the future.
Yeah.
Right. That's not an energy decision. It's a land use decision. Making more compact neighborhoods that are walkable is not, immediately doesn't look like an energy decision, but it really turns out to be an energy decision. You see what I mean? So those are decisions that, again, we will hear from Dubuque and Des Moines about the kind of things they have imagined and envisioned to do for their planning. But that's what a community climate action plan or plan of resilience. That's why, you know, some communities call it different things.
Well, let's invite Dubuque into the conversation, Komiar. Gina Bell is with us, Dubuque's Sustainable Community Coordinator, joining us by phone. Gina, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I understand, and Komiar can back me up and comment after you do, but I understand Dubuque is really ahead of the curve, has been ahead of the curve in terms of climate action for some years. When did it all begin there?
Yeah, I'd say it really started when our former mayor, Roy Buell, ran for office in 2005. And he ran on a platform to engage citizens as partners. And what he heard while he was campaigning was people cared about each other. They cared about the environment. They cared about the economy. And, you know, he looked at the sustainability framework and thought, hey, this is our issue. And so in 2006, then he worked with his council colleagues. And our city council set sustainability as a top priority, and it has been a top priority since. And then in 2008, 2 short years later, the city of Dubuque hired the first sustainability coordinator in Iowa. And then we were able to work with community activists and, you know, some political will to set a goal like Komiar was talking about. And so in 2011, city council adopted the goal of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 50% of our 2003 levels by 2030. And that continues to be our goal.
Are you making headway toward that goal?
We are, yeah. In our last emissions inventory, we were about 27% reduction, and we'll be doing another inventory this coming year, and hopefully we'll have continued to make progress toward that goal.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask, what are your thoughts hearing about the passage of what has been titled the Inflation Reduction Act and the hundreds of billions of dollars put towards a problem that we have recognized for years, but at a federal level have failed to engage meaningfully?
Yeah, it's really exciting. I think that we have a lot of the solutions that we need, but funding has always been a challenge. And so this is a great opportunity for cities like Dubuque that have a climate action plan and are implementing it, as well as other cities, to get on board and start taking action to reduce our emissions.
Mm-hmm. We have about 2 minutes before a break. Let me go back to you, Komiar, and comment about Dubuque and its efforts here in the larger context of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what Gina described, you know, I've gone to Dubuque many times. I've gone, they host this amazing Sustainable Cities Conference, which is just a wonderful forum for exchange of ideas. So it's really exemplary work of city council, city staff, citizens, all working together, very shared, really shared goals of getting things done in their own communities. That's impressive, really impressive.
Gina, when you do get pushback or have over the years of 10 plus years that this is action has been taking place in Dubuque, where does it come from? What is the nature of the pushback?
You know, I think when I started my role about 4 years ago, the pushback that I heard was people didn't believe in climate change or didn't believe it was caused by humans. And I think we have to accept the empirical evidence that it is caused by human beings, and we have to solve for it. And so I tried to address people's concerns, but also couldn't get stuck in their disbelief, and so just moved forward.
Yeah, it's heavily politicized. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Of course, this act passed with no Republican support, and those are elected officials reflecting attitudes across the state, across the country. So we'll get your view on it, Komiar. I know you want to comment on that, but we've got to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. We have the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. What a resource he and his center are for the entire state, Komiar and Cheyenne, and also Gina Bell, Dubuque Sustainable Community Coordinator. We're talking about what communities can do to stem climate change and how the federal money coming our way may help. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment.
Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, tackling climate change and how we can stem that climate change and also think about the sustainability of our communities, our state, and our planet. Joining us for the entire hour, Komiar and Cheyenne, director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. Gina Bell with us as well, really a shining example of what a community can do to take local action on climate change. She's Dubuque's Sustainable Community Coordinator. And in just a moment, we'll check out the scene in Des Moines. But when we had to go to break, Komiar, we didn't have a chance for you to respond to what we were talking about. We have, of course, all this political debate tied up in climate change, no Republicans voting yes for this Inflation Reduction Act with hundreds of billions of dollars of climate and energy related funding. Republicans may saying not wanting to speak for them, but you know, it's the how to tackle climate change, not if you climate change there. So I guess the question here is, how divided are we, politics aside, how divided are we over the necessity of earnestly tackling climate change at a local, state, and national and global level?
Well, I can really speak to, again, my experience in my community. And I think we should point to kind of refocus the conversation towards what we share in common in where we live, in our state, in our communities. And the reality is the floods are coming, bigger storms, all these things. These are happening. This is not hypothetical. It's already happening. And really, we expect public officials to make decisions based on science and evidence, right? I mean, we expect them, when a bridge is built, when a road is built, when a building is built, we expect it to be based on science and evidence, right? It's not based on rumors and this and that. It's based on science and evidence. And the same, so when a city wants to protect their floodplain and do good things, capture emissions that are leaving their landfill, et cetera, et cetera. This is just good, basic practice, best practices that public officials want to do for their communities. It's really not about partisan politics. It's about doing kind of our obligation to protect public health and safety in our communities. So that's the way I view it. And kind of my role as a public servant is to act based on evidence and serve my community. So that's how I kind of see this, not as a kind of a big divisive debate, but as a reality that we need to deal with.
Let's have Josh Mandelbaum join us. He's a Des Moines City Council member, senior attorney at the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Council Member Mandelbaum, welcome to our program.
Great to be here, Ben.
Give us a view of the Des Moines Climate Action Plan. When did it start? What have you achieved?
Yeah, so Des Moines is actually in process of putting together our first comprehensive climate action plan. So we're working with the community and with a couple different consultants to develop our plan. And part of what comes out of that, we've actually had goals in place and key policies in place, but never that comprehensive plan in place. So for example, we've had the first goal that we adopted was consistent with the Paris Agreement to have a 28% reduction by 2025. We've subsequently added a couple goals to make sure that we are on track to do the things we need to do what we see out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. And so that was a 45% emission reduction by 2030, net zero by 2050. And then we layered on as one of the strategies to meet those goals. We have a 100% 24/7 carbon-free electricity goal by 2035. We have our Building Energy and Water Conservation Benchmarking Ordinance, which we are currently implementing. And that goes at one of the largest sources of emissions, which is our building use and our largest buildings. And it gets them to start measuring their energy use and comparing how they're doing to efficient buildings. That is in place now. And then we have other pieces that already exist. For example, our Urban Forest Master Plan, which is both a resilience strategy and an efficiency strategy. It hits multiple pieces. all of those things are in place and we've started implementing, but we have a lot of work to do to get those to the end piece. And our climate action plan will wrap all those things together and identify additional strategies that, that we need to be looking at and implementing.
Mm-hmm. Call me our comment on what Josh just said and where Dubuque finds itself right now.
Yeah, Des Moines and Dubuque, yes. I really admire this work. It's ambitious, and exactly that's where the funds need to go to help communities implement these plans. It's really incredible. And that everyone, well, the city can only do so much, right? They're doing what they can, but really it's going to take everyone, churches, school, businesses, utilities, everybody. It's not something city alone can do, and I'm sure city of Des Moines officials are very cognizant of that, but it's just such an ambitious goal, so inspiring to hear these.
Yeah. Josh Mandelbaum, talk about that, the challenge of buy-in. Have you received pushback to energy efficiency? See, did you anticipate that in the future? I would think you would, but how do you overcome that? As Komyar just pointed out, you know, you can, it can't be just the leaders of a community. It has to be, there has to be community buy-in and people working on individual levels.
Yeah, one of the things that we have great buy-in from our residents, you know, they've been tremendous advocates in this. We have a task force on sustainability that has really helped lead the charge on a number of the different policy pieces. But there are also areas where we get resistance. We went through an almost year-long stakeholder process on our energy benchmarking ordinance, and we still had a number of the large building owners that were resistant to that policy. And
why? What's behind the resistance?
Well, so some of them, they thought that we were just trying to embarrass them, for example. So our policy and where we settled was that we would create transparency and a data-driven process. And so we were going to measure how our buildings were doing and let people know if our buildings were good performing buildings or poor performing buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And there were building owners that didn't like that idea. They thought that was just designed to embarrass them. Now, you have to ask, why would they be embarrassed if they're doing the things they can to create efficient buildings and address climate? You know, that to me is an interesting question. But part of what we did to address that concern is we created time, right? So we've been implementing our benchmarking ordinance for several years now, but we're not having any of the data go public until the end of this year for the first time. And so that gives a building owner an opportunity to look at what they're doing and start implementing practices. So by the time we share data public, if they were a poor performer, hopefully they've upped their game and taken action and become more efficient, and they're no longer a poor performer. And that's the way that we did this, listening to input and trying to get buy-in, but recognizing that there was work to do and that folks would have to do work to get where we want to be.
That's very interesting. Gina Bell, to you in Dubuque, how have you tackled this problem? You've been at it more years and in implementation here. It's easy to, you know, put laurels on the performers out there, the buildings, the businesses that really do well are ahead of the curve, but you have these poor performers. Tell us about how you have dealt with them.
So Dubuque doesn't have a energy benchmarking ordinance yet, but a lot of our focus has really been on what the city government can do, and we can't do it alone. We do need the community to do it. Our climate action plan is community-wide, but we really want to set the example, and it is to both build resiliency and the experience of for residents of Dubuque, and so you have to try to see what's going to happen, and not everything we've done has been a success, but a lot of what we have been able to do, I think about our B Blanche B Branch watershed and flood mitigation project has been a real game changer for a lot of residents in downtown Dubuque who were experiencing consistent flooding and all of the damage that goes along with that, including mold issues. And by creating this mitigation system, we've changed their entire experience of being a resident in Dubuque. And so we do want to focus on the things that go well.
Gina Bell is with us from Dubuque, where she's a sustainable community coordinator. Josh Mandelbaum is a Des Moines City Council member, and Kamyar Enshayan is the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at UNI, taking a look at local action, community action to stem climate change. But it's bigger than that, as Kamyar then pointed out. It's about sustainability, how we live, inhabit this planet without having all kinds of weather scenarios rain down on us. I mean, they already are. So it's a matter of stemming that. I want to ask you, Kamyar, about state laws. How have state laws in recent years worked well with your efforts or the community's efforts? I want to ask our communities as well to pass mandates to help curb waste and emissions. Have state laws helped? Could they be more helpful?
They could be more helpful, but I would say there are several things. You know, the solar tax credit that the legislators extended, that's a good thing. And in terms of energy, I'm really, state policy has not been my strength. So I would say, incentivizing renewable energy at the community scale, any policy that would encourage that, it's going to be very beneficial. I would say, again, I'm thinking of resilience and dealing with floods of the future. The state, ought to up the game on strengthening, giving more room to the rivers, which means making larger floodplains, like the 500-year floodplain, the regulatory floodplain for most communities. That would save us a lot of headache, a lot of costs. A lot of these are not easy to achieve. As you heard from City of Des Moines, they're tackling the building energy use. It's amazing. It's very admirable. And because in our studies, we've seen that the largest equivalent of emissions are coming from actually heating, cooling, and lighting buildings. Of all things, you would think like vehicles would be the biggest, but it turns out for city operations, it's just the buildings.
Yeah,
and
right.
So we got to build better buildings. And if we can change our city energy codes, improve it statewide, that would help dramatically.
We have some input from listeners in just a moment, but I wanted to get to Josh and Gina here. What about state laws, Josh Mandelbaum? Have they been a help, or what do you wish they would do in the future?
Well, they've actually... the solar tax credit that Kamyar mentioned was a help, but a lot of the other things that the state has done has been a hindrance. So, for example, the state passed a law in 2018 that gutted longstanding energy efficiency programs in Iowa that were national leaders. And that makes it harder for us once we implement our building benchmarking. There are fewer resources available for those buildings to implement energy efficiency than there were in the past. The state hasn't adopted the most recent building and energy conservation codes, and those set a baseline for our new buildings going forward that are really important. And the state has preempted tools like gas bans for new construction, all of which force us at the local level to be more creative. And so one of the things that we're looking at as a response as a city from Des Moines' perspective is, how do we use our incentives to be consistent with our climate goals? Mm. So it's my belief that we shouldn't be incentivizing any new building that isn't going to be able to help us meet our long-term climate goals.
Gina Bell.
And so,
yeah. I wanted to switch over to Gina Bell. Are you facing some of the same things there in Dubuque that Josh is describing in Des Moines in terms of it seems not playing in concert the state laws and the local laws?
Yeah, and Josh really covered a lot of the same challenges that we have. The only big item that I would add is our water quality needs to be addressed at a statewide level as well.
Okay, let's get to some listener input before our hour ends. Sharon is listening. She writes, can you ask your guests to talk about ethanol in this discussion? Comyar, address that here.
Well, again, it's a contentious thing, as we know. The thing is, we got to think about solutions that really reduce our dependence on fossil energy. Ethanol has several problems. One is that the production of corn, the way it is done in Iowa, is damaging our soils, our waters, and there's like all kinds of and biodiversity. So that it can't really be called renewable. It is what it is. It is incorrect to call it renewable. And if we're going to move towards renewable, then in my opinion, ethanol is not a route to go, particularly at a time when we're talking electrification, and we know solar and wind are native energy sources as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me toss this next comment from Grant. First of all, to you, Josh Mandelbaum. This is Grant in Ames. He writes, too many towns focus on replacing combustion cars with electric cars. Towns and cities need to make infrastructure for walking and cycling and transit safer to be more attractive to residents. The shift of car trips to other modes of transport have greater gains for greenhouse gas reduction. Josh, what do you think of that comment from our listener, Grant in Ames?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that comment. I mean, if we're going to have a comprehensive climate action plan, we need to think about transportation from a multimodal perspective. And that's doing things like implementing a complete streets policy. So as we reconstruct our streets, we're thinking about what kind of sidewalks and bike infrastructure and transit infrastructure exist on that street. A really good example of a piece that we're doing in Des Moines is the reconstruction of Ingersoll, where we're adding protected bike lanes and wider sidewalks. That is meant to be a truly multimodal street, and that's better for the businesses too, because more people can get to those businesses easier. And that's part of what a comprehensive approach to these issues can accomplish.
Right. I can only echo that as someone who bikes commutes to work on a bike and also gets around town on a bike. It makes so much difference, those dedicated bike paths, walking paths, when you don't feel you're taking your life in your own hands and it's properly divided up. We're coming to the end of the hour. I wanted to give you some last words, perhaps things that were not mentioned yet, Comyar, that we need to fit into this conversation before the hour ends in a couple minutes.
I'll just say that there are many layers of involvement as citizens of Iowa, as people who work here at the household level, neighborhood, city, school, county, state. We have so much work to do, and I hope this bill will provide some funding for all of us to think about what we could do in our communities.
Mm-hmm. How can a person in a community spur their community into action, perhaps a community without a climate action plan, a community that's behind the curve here?
Well, we have actually a great network we call Resilient Iowa Communities that we've been facilitating over the last year. And we actually, if any community would like to start the conversation, they can contact me and we would meet with them and explain what their goals are, and we'll get the ball rolling like we've done with many other cities. So yeah, we actually particularly focus on smaller communities that may not have a big planning staff. That's what we could do.
Mm-hmm. Gina Bell, before we go in the few seconds, what are your thoughts on spurring more into action, more individuals to perhaps change minds, perhaps apply pressure in their community to get going on this?
Yeah, I think being vocal about it and sharing your concerns. Politicians work for residents, and you need, they, if they don't hear from you, they don't know that you're concerned about this. And I really think that it's both an equity and a climate issue. And if we focus on the impacts to human beings, we have a really viable case. And so we need to vote, and we need to tell our representatives and our city councilors, hey, this is important, and here's what we want you to do. Here's some actions we can take. And I think that's the best way to go about it.
Gina Bell is the Dubuque Sustainable Community Coordinator, Josh Mandelbaum, Des Moines City Council member, and Komyar and Cheyenne, Director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you all for joining us and sharing your perspectives this hour.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, gun violence takes an immense toll on victims, their families, and friends, but the ripple effects go much wider. Tomorrow, my guest will be Iowa City-based psychologist Holly Sanger. We'll talk about coping with anxiety caused by the gun violence epidemic tomorrow on our program. Today's River to River, produced by Danny Gear with help from Natalie Dunlop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talk to you again tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.